Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Thank you for joining us tonight. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to the Kindling's Muse, and we're now going to go out to our audience and let them address their questions to our esteemed panel, which has been with me listening to a lot of interesting comments from the audience tonight. And now we get to get back to them and ask them some of our questions. And let's get started with Susan.
An area that I'm concerned about is persecution and oppression and martyrdom of Christians around the world. And what can we do to address that? What can we do about that?
Okay. What about the fact that in places like Sudan or China, there's many countries in the world where there is religious persecution? Is that an issue that ought to rise near the top in terms of justice issues? And what should we be doing about it?
Well, you know, freedom of religion is really a justice issue, and it needs to be a universal justice issue. And, you know, under the Clinton administration, there is actually a cabinet-level position that was established to relate to persecution in the world and persecuted believers, whether they were Christian or Muslim or Jewish or of any faith. You may remember that Bob Seipel, who was a former chief executive of World Vision, was the first ambassador of that. Since that time, I don't believe that has been given the same level of attention that it was under the Clinton administration, and it's a real concern. Apart from kind of a State Department or a government-to-government intervention, it's difficult to address those issues because by the fact that the very structures that we would relate to among the church are the very things that are being persecuted. So it seems as though the only or at least the most obvious avenue is to really engage our government and the State Department in advocacy for believers in other countries.
Okay, let's go to Karen.
I guess my question is, I guess to me that statistic of the middle class was completely alarming, although I live in it and I understand that. And for me, I think that the middle class or lower to middle class are actually the most generous in their giving to these AIDS projects, to these other, you know, buy some land. And so I'm kind of concerned that we should help them in order to keep helping the other things, because those people understand empathy, and the empathy that they have, that the daily struggles that we live as middle class or lower to middle class or whatever class you're in, is really going to sustain all these other issues.
Okay, is it unjust to have a healthy, strong emphasis and focus on sustaining the middle class in America, given the dollar a day that so many others are living on? You know, we've got ourselves in a situation where health insurance and basic living costs in America are exceeding what the middle class worker is able to generate often. Is that a justice issue, and how does it relate to the bigger global poverty issues?
I think it is a justice issue. And, you know, everything is relative. Sometimes you'll hear, you know, parents would say, you've got to clean your plate off because people in China are starving. Well, I don't run into people in China. I grew up in Kentucky and no China people there. So I think the problem comes when most Americans think that they are middle class. The reality is most Americans are working class or lower class. You put the two of those groups together, and that's 70% of Americans. So to sustain the middle class, I think that's great. But when you have more equality between all social classes instead of this huge jump, you know, that gets really troubling. So, and I would like to also say that in terms of Americans being generous, clearly, when our economy is good, it helps everyone because we have such a vital religious economy that we do give. What's interesting, though, is that Americans being the most charitable people in the world in some ways, that's hard to look at because Americans mostly give to their own congregations and not to other things, although there's a huge segment of American Christians who do give to things like AGROS and AIDS awareness. So the middle class already gets a lot of government subsidy, and most people don't recognize it. Less than 2% of the federal budget goes to people who are poor, but 33% of the federal budget goes to sustain people who are already in the middle class. So in some ways, we already are providing subsidy to those folks.
Well, and the generosity index is an interesting one, because I think that the average American gives 1.9% of their income to charitable causes. So on the one hand, you hear in churches across America, we're the most generous people in the world. America is great because America is good, to Tocqueville. On the other hand, the reality is, while there are certain people that are giving very sacrificially, most people are kind of giving as an afterthought to charitable causes. And in the case of religious people who give a higher percentage, a lot of it's going to their local church, which often is building bigger buildings and, you know, paying more staff expenses and so forth. I think you wanted to add something over there.
Yeah, I think that we need to be careful not to isolate one group. In the global economy, we're all interconnected. And so we can't talk about just helping one group rather than another group, because how the American economy does depends on the fact that there, I don't forget what the number was in terms of number of people who live on a dollar a day. If you live on a dollar a day, you don't buy anything. The American economy does well when we can sell things. And so we will do better if the poor in other countries and in our own country are doing well, because that will invigorate our own economy. And so I think these things are interconnected. And so to say, well, we should take care of the middle class and then worry about someone somewhere else.
My point was, is I'm giving so much money away that lowers me down the class. If I would keep my money, I would be up with the richer people, because some of them might be keeping their money. That's what I was saying, is your causes are not falling on deaf ears, is that we're running into the availability to support these causes because we are empathetic and generous-hearted towards these causes.
Okay. Let's go to Dina.
My question is, we joked earlier about checking our clothing tags to see who might be wearing Abercrombie and Fitch and supporting pornography. And I wonder how many of us would feel as shameful for wearing labels that were made in China and for supporting a different kind of slavery that Wilberforce fought against in the name of free trade.
Okay, this is a huge one. I have gotten physically ill at some outlet stores watching teenagers who feel like if they don't get this item of clothing, they just can't be popular. And the item of clothing costs $38, and the person who made it probably got 30 cents. And when you know these things, we live in America. But we also, the more you know, the more you begin to realize what the implications are of that. What do you say, panel?
There's a great website called Shop with a Conscience for information about, increasingly, we have opportunities to use what money we do spend on ourselves to make a political statement, to reward companies that treat their workers, that treat the environment in just ways. And through the internet, we have access to the information so that we can increasingly live out a kind of lifestyle justice by rewarding companies that do things well.
You know, I'm a parent of two teenagers, and this reality has struck home in a big way, especially for my daughter, who lives under this enormous pressure of fitting in, styling right, not standing out in a negative way, and it brings it into our home. And one is relating to the values reality of what she's going through and what my son is going through. But the second is that it takes enormous amount of effort to stay on top of these values issues, on these values decisions. It takes an enormous amount of determination. It takes enormous amount of effort to be educated about the choices, because so much of our life just happens and we just live into choices that we may be ignorant about the implications of. And it takes an enormous amount of effort to stay on top of that.
I'm going to throw a little fly in the ointment here. I went to an event in the late 80s that was an international event of, quote, younger leaders. And I remember the North American delegation being very conscious that we were wealthier. And it was a situation where 40 people were there from Latin America, 40 people from Asia. It was a global event. And so we were very conscious to not spend money. And this is anecdotal, but it's still a real reality. We were shocked at the people coming from poorer countries and how much they were shopping. And it's as if they, you know, the people that we're trying to be sensitive to were in a situation where they could buy stuff at this event, you know? And so there's something in when you make this argument to your kids where they say, well, basically all those kids over there would like to be able to buy what I'm buying. I mean, they want to have the same stuff we do. Why should I give up what they want? You know, because they're not going to get it anyway. So what do you say to it?
Go ahead.
My kids are a little bit older, so they've passed through safely, I hope, through the teen years. When my daughter was 15, dealt with many of those same issues of wanting to be accepted, and you get accepted by looking a certain way. Took her to Brazil for 6 weeks, spent 6 weeks looking at community development projects, looking at living with poor families. She came back, and the first thing her friends asked her to do was to go preschool shopping, because it was in the end of August, and she couldn't go. She couldn't go, because it wasn't her parents' values. She had seen it herself, and it made a difference. It had become internalized for her. It wasn't doing what Dad wanted. It was now she had seen the faces, she had seen the people, and she couldn't be the same again. So I think it's important that that our children be exposed as much as possible. As parents, I think it was often there's a tendency to want to protect. But I think it's just as important to expose to the hard things, not just...
Okay. Let's go to Lyle.
One of the fastest growing churches in Seattle, in my opinion, has a emphasis that relegates women to a second class status. Why are they so successful?
Let the sociologist of religion take this one. And quoting the pastor of the same church, I'll just lean over the plate and take this one for the team. In sociology of religion, I use this phrase a lot, religious economies. The U.S. has the most vital religious economy in the world. What that means is that we're very pluralistic, and the catchphrase that we use is only conservative churches grow. Now, I don't like the word conservative. In fact, there's probably the most famous article that was written that deals with this is called Why Strict Churches Are Strong. And it gets back to this idea of fundamentalism, that if you can create boundaries and clear rules, then you can create solidarity with your group because you know what you stand against. You almost define yourself by what you're not, and that creates an easy rallying cry. Which is why mainline churches, which are the more theologically liberal churches, are losing over 1 million members a year, because that's so much more amorphous when you just talk about love and social justice. There's nothing to grab onto. So churches that are able to create solid sound bites that seem to work with the larger cultural biases, because you can say this one church, it's not only the fastest growing church in Seattle, it's one of the fastest growing churches in the country. It's in the top 25 of the most influential churches in the country. And it's because the message, I don't want to say it's simplified, but when you can create a strict set of boundaries for a group, you create a successful social movement. Because it's clear, and everyone knows what they are coming together for, but more importantly, what they're coming together against.
Christy.
I was having a conversation with a friend today about injustice in the world really being built upon societal conduct, whether it be sins, I'll use that and with quotes, of omission or commission. And I'm just wondering, in your opinions, what are some contemporary changes of conduct in society that can bring about positive societal change?
You know, it kind of gets back to some of the conversation, or the earlier the the question before this last one about the values clarification issues, and part of the issue is deciding as an individual and maybe as a community what is enough. How do we define enough in a context in the context of a society that is constantly striving for more and more and more, whether that's more income, more experience, more things, more status? At some point, in a context of a community or as an individual, we need to begin to understand what is enough. What is the biblical idea of enough? We talk about, striving or trying to preserve the notion of a middle class or preserve our status as a middle class. Well, you know, middle class is great because in some sense there's a sense of having enough. But the reality of the middle class in America is that it's a way station for folks that want to be affluent. So at some point we have to come to a sense of resolve around what is enough and to live into that notion in the context of a global reality, in the context of a global neighborhood. Not merely a neighborhood that's defined by me and mine, but rather the context of a much broader neighborhood that takes into account peoples of all nations and the ta ethna of the Bible, the community of all peoples, and trying to understand that.
Can I just add to that? We were a nation founded on the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and I think we've missed it there because the life is about the pursuit of joy. And what is it? This is the idea of what is it that brings joy, and it's not having more. But it is about relationships that are healthy and whole. In other words, just relationships. And that's where joy comes. And I think that's where most people, when you talk to them, where they experience joy, it is in positive, healthy relationships. And if we could turn to that focus on pursuing that kind of joy in just relationships and away from a kind of pseudo-happiness that we think will come from things, it would be a huge step.
Well, this has been very, very interesting tonight. And those of you whose questions we didn't get to, we apologize, but we'll be posting them at the website. And those of you listening to the podcast can go to the website, thekindlings.com, and read some of the more questions and comment on them. As always, we ask each of our guests on the panel to make a final comment. And again, we want to thank Dina Berg for being here from Agros, Christy Doakes from Acting on AIDS, and Jeff Keenan from Our Day to End Poverty. And they have some materials over here for those of you that are here tonight that take a look at and see some of the ways that you can get involved in these issues. And we want to now turn for a final comment from each of our panelists, and we'll start with Reverend Ken Kierstead from University Presbyterian Church.
Well, I would just give a word of encouragement, and it's along the line of our author, Mr. Keenan, and that is with regards to engaging in justice issues, I would invoke the Warren Buffett's principle of investment. Do what you know. Invest in what you know. Whatever it is that's in front of you that you have some conviction around and you have an understanding of some steps of action or engagement that you can take, just do that. And you'll be surprised at how those actions of engagement will lead you deeper into something else that you will discover and then begin to know. And that will lead you deeper into something into a deeper engagement. So I would just want to encourage you. I mean, you're all here because you're interested in the subject, so you're already being about the issues of justice. And so I would just want to encourage you to do what you know.
Dr. Jennifer McKinney, sociologist and focusing on religion at Seattle Pacific University.
Playing off what Ken said, and you mentioned earlier, you know, in the North American church, we tend to go to the church that serves whatever we already believe. And so I think that in talking about justice, you need to be a little bit careful because, you know, folks are here, they're probably fairly like-minded, but sometimes you have to ask the question, who's justice? And you have to ask the question, we keep talking about the church and how the church helps us to address justice issues, and you have to ask the question, whose church along with whose justice? You know, I disagree that abortion and homosexuality are the only moral issues. When you've got a million people a year over a period of 7 years falling into poverty, that's a moral issue as well. So you have to think through, for people of faith, how do we come together and not be divisive? Because when you have a pluralistic religious society, that's hugely vital, but it's also very, very divisive. So my concern is to bring people together on these issues. And I had a student who just today, in the course of class, raised her hand and said, you know, before I took some of these sociology classes, I was ignorant, but I was happy. And
you're a myth buster and an unhappiness creator.
And she said, you know, now I know these things, and I want the happy ending. I want to live in a world, and clearly this world doesn't have a happy ending. And that's the great thing about teaching at Seattle Pacific. And you don't want to destroy faith, but you need to be much more thoughtful about the commitments that you make, especially in the name of Christ. And I was able to say to her, you know, the reality is that there is a happy ending because Jesus wins this fight, regardless of how less than perfect we are, regardless of how we don't know some of the effects of our own actions. You know, Jesus wins. And so you have to have hope, but you also have to be careful to not just lump together that justice is one thing or that the church can do one thing, because, you know, clearly we're not coming together.
Dr. Kevin Neuhauser, also from Seattle Pacific.
I spend a lot of my life teaching students about the injustices of the world, and it often they become, depressed, but I wouldn't go that far. They come disempowered, disanimated, because the problems are so big, so complicated, so interlocking, that they can't figure out where to get a handle on it. I had a student in my office, and she had sort of explained something, and I started to talk, and she goes, I know, it's more complicated. That's one thing I've learned. It's always more complicated. And that makes it hard. And so periodically, I try to encourage them. One of the things I do when I take students to Brazil is get them to meet people who have sustained effort against injustice over the long haul, so that they can talk to people who have maintained hope and courage and joy in that over the long haul. Because I think students, when they're young, they often have a very short time horizon. And if so, if they can't solve slavery in the first year, they give up. And so there are two pieces of advice I tell them over and over, and that is, start small. Find one thing that you can do today. Don't try to solve the whole problem. Find one thing that you can do that pushes a little bit. And the other thing I say is find a community that will sustain you, because nobody can do it alone. You have to be surrounded by people who will sustain you. Otherwise, you will burn out.
Well, thank you so much, panel, and our guests from different organizations and all of you here tonight. I'm going to close with a quote from William Wilberforce, who said, "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." And what he meant by reformation of manners was he believed that we ought to try to make goodness fashionable. And if there is a good word in starting with an understanding of justice, of doing unto others as we would have them do unto us, would be to make that fashionable, to make that a good value, to make that something that we all can agree on. And I also remind us that we have so much in common as human beings that ought to be our starting point on these issues, even before our religious convictions, is our human convictions, because we're all created in the image of God. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for joining us on the Kindling's Muse. We'll look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you for listening to the Kindling's Muse. If this program sparks something in you, I invite you to participate at www.thekindlings.com. That's KINDLINGS. Share this program, tell a friend, or just leave a comment at www.thekindlings.com.